I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
He's round the goalkeeper, he's done it! Absolutely incredible!
He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Does it tame and tame and tame again?
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
The ancient art of players failing to grasp they've just played in a cup game and not a league game. Precocious UEFA referees. Not even horse racing is immune from the close-up of a legend in the crowd commentary urge. Wayne Rooney's childhood match of the day dream. Can you have a dream restart? The perfect goal. Matt Letitier gets comprehensively out-weirdoed, Andy Gray answering his own questions, and Keezy lays the groundwork for an unlikely yet somehow perfect collaboration. Brought to your ears by Goalhanger Podcasts, this is Football Clichés. Hello everyone and welcome to Football Clichés. I'm Adam Hurry. This is the Adjudication Panel. With me, Charlie Eccleshare. Hello.
Hello.
And David Walker. How are things?
Things are good, yeah.
Excellent. Charlie, safe to say there were twists and turns in the title race this week. And slam dunk of a twist and turner.
Yeah, it's about as twisty and turny as you're going to get with two of the three teams losing.
Dave, Keezy called along similar lines, I think. He went very bold with his declaration for this weekend.
Then there were two. They know.
Broadcasters, Dave, love it when they get to roll out. And then there were two.
Love to know what he said after the Arsenal result. But there were lots of people on Twitter as well doing the, oh, so that was fun while it lasted. Or
yeah. Quite annoying, actually.
So much for the best title race ever and all that sort of thing. Yeah. I was around someone's house yesterday. I wasn't watching the football, but I was kind of keeping tabs on the scores. And when I saw that Arsenal were losing, you know, I was kind of same similar sort of thing going, oh, God, that's so annoying. I really want it to go all the way to the wire. The guy I was with turned to me and went, yeah, but there will be more twists and turns though, right? And I was like, I don't know.
There will, mate. I promise you. Don't know why this weekend felt so definitive for a lot of people. Charlie, it felt like a lot of people were looking for a definitive analysis of the title race. What is the rush, do you think, to reach this sort of judgment like Keezy has there with six games to go? What's the huge impetus to do it?
I don't know. I think it's just entirely... Well, I think part of it's instinctive. I think at this stage of the season, things matter so much. It's hard not to think that that's just it and it's set. But I find it so funny, like last week Spurs won, Villa dropped points, and it was, you know, Spurs are up to fourth with a game in hand and Villa go to Arsenal next weekend, so you know, by the end of that Spurs will have it sewn up. Then this week it flips and now it's like, oh well, you know, Villa have got it, you know, they've just got to beat an Arsenal, there's no way they won't get fourth now. Like, it's the recency bias is incredible. And I get it in the case of City, because you're up against City, and yes, we know they go on these kind of mad runs and they win every game.
I heard that a lot yesterday.
Which obviously plays into it. But yeah, I think it's just so much is made of these games. It's hard to then ever imagining anything will change. Like, oh no, Arsenal now are back to being completely useless. Liverpool will never win a game again and it's all done. But because literally no one, I've heard so few people, apart from relative to City, because I think City you can basically just stick with they're going to win it throughout. But you know, a couple of weeks ago, Liverpool went top, and then it was like, well, advantage Liverpool.
Yeah.
And then Arsenal, well, advantage Arsenal. Ah, advantage. And like, obviously, advantage
is different. It's like the supercomputer, Charlie.
Yeah, exactly. Supercomputer all over again.
Dave, there are other biases involved. Paul Merson's post-match punditry after Arsenal lost against Aston Villa was essentially based on him being an Arsenal sort of advocate and then just falling back on the fact that, well, City are going to win it now, aren't they? Because they're going to go on the big run now. That kind of reverse psychology aspect to it. That there are essentially no solid foundations for anyone to make any sort of conclusions on the rest of the title race now, is there? there's always going to be some sort of weird vested interest involved.
I think there's a bit of self-preservation from particularly Arsenal fans, maybe Liverpool too, but like, yeah, it's kind of, they're not even going to let themselves hope because this happened before. I mean, the City factor is huge though. They have shifted it. I wonder back in the late 90s or whatever, when, you know, when there were close title races between United and Arsenal, and did people talk about it in the same way then? I don't know. Can you remember, Charlie?
Well, I do. I remember in the 96-97 title race, which is the lowest points tally ever. United won it with 75 in the Premier League era. They won it with 75. And there was a lot of, in the Premier League years from that season, there was a lot of Keyes earnings like, well, Newcastle thought they were out of it, but they're now right back in it. And it's Liverpool who appear to be out of it. And they kept, because all the teams and Arsenal, those three were chasing with United, all those teams kept losing games. So there was a constant, you know how Sky, they'll sort of push a narrative of like, are they out of it now? Can we say they're officially out of it, sort of thing? There was loads of that going on. So I think we do like to, we always like to kind of write teams out of it completely. It's quite sort of a convenient shorthand.
I wondered in that sort of era of Manchester United dominance, did we have kind of fun while it lasted discourse? Was that a thing back then? I can't remember. But what I am glad to see is we haven't reached the stage where the interviewer after the match day felt compelled to ask Klopp if he was sort of conceding defeat in the title race, like he was sort of behind in the polls on election day.
As an interviewer, you can't go there. You can, if you're a fan,
it's
or whatever,
early.
We're still, as you point out, Charlie, we're still within one result of everything being turned around. And that's the thing that we always forget. You get it quite often.
Why is that so beyond people to imagine?
You get it quite a lot of relegation battles as well. You go, well, that's them down. Like in February, they'll lose a game. The team will lose a game in February. They're done now. We know that.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, they could just win next week. They might win next week and then they're back in it.
Well, Dave, I remember like when the flip of that, when Watford beat Liverpool in that famous 3-0 that, you know, was the first defeat Liverpool suffered. And Watford at that point, they looked great under Pearson. It was like, oh, well, then, you know, they're all good. They'll stay up.
They're fine.
And then, yeah, they'll be fine. And they weren't.
Then the world went to shit the week after.
Well, more on that later on. Right, let's adjudication panel. Let's cast our minds back a little further to the Champions League last week. Arsenal 2, Bayern Munich 2 at the Emirates. Here's Leandro Trossard and Harry Kane being interviewed afterwards. And I feel like this is one of the longest serving subtype of footballers' post-match interview muscle memory.
I think not pleased, but obviously when you're 2-1 down at halftime, you take a point at the end.
Overall, it was a really tough game and... Of course, we're never happy not to win, but you know, it was a tough point away from home.
A lot of people remain stunned by this when it happens, Dave, but it does go on. It's amazing, isn't it? Are they sort of that mentally checked out? Are they that focused on the game itself that they don't think about the immediate context of it?
I think, yeah, there's a huge amount of autopilot going on there. You can just sort of see it in their eyes. They're kind of just searching for the words that they need to get through this question. And they're so used to saying them. They might sort of have forgotten themselves. It probably feels like it is a point, I suppose. The mentality of it's the same.
The concept of the points, Charlie, both sort of in literal direct terms and also as just simply a concept. It's so ingrained in footballers' post-match interviews that you can kind of see how it's happened here.
Yeah, I think it. We all know what it means. It's, you know, it does make sense. Also, there have been, obviously this isn't them, but just sort of broadening the genre. There have been examples, haven't there, of foreign players playing in cup ties and not realising that they were playing cup ties.
Right.
And thinking that they were draws.
Okay.
I remember there was one, apparently, this may be apocryphal, but in that Arsenal-Reading 7-5 game, I think Giroud and maybe Coquelin threw their shirts into the crowd at the end of a pulsating 5-all draw. Thinking like, oh, well, that's done. Only to be told you still kind of need your shirts because you've got another half hour to play.
That shouldn't be apocryphal. There should be footage of it actually happening.
Yeah, I'll try and dig
not
that out.
Not accepting apocryphal for that. What was that, 2012?
Yeah, there was another one. I think it was a Reading player who was caught out and told like, oh, you do realise that was a cup tie.
Elsewhere at the Emirates, this one came from Duncan Moyer. Just before the hour mark, funnily enough, Bukayo Saka being chopped down and the commentator seeking some opinion from his co-commentators on it.
And a commercial tackle from there, it is beautiful. Just let that through you. Commit the foul. You've got a free kick in a dangerous area. We saw it with the goal in the first half. We see it again.
Surprised that's not a yellow?
Okay, potentially being, yes, a little bit, yeah.
For a young referee, he's been quite aggressive in kind of the way he's kind of ref the game and give cards.
I don't think I've ever heard this observation before, Charlie, about whether the age of the referee might affect their temperament in officiating a game. Confused by this.
Yeah, I can sort of see, yeah, I'm trying to think, have there been like young, prodigious refs that have come through? Was Michael Oliver...
Michael Oliver is I think the ultimate, we can't believe how young he is.
Yeah.
He's older than some of the, he's younger than some of the players kind of situation.
Yeah, I do like the idea of them getting carried away or something, you know, like a youngster might snatch at a chance, might a young ref do something similar.
Yeah, Dave, this is basically the kind of along the lines of what he meant, but I would have thought it would be flipped round the other way. Mm. Wouldn't you?
There is that moment when you're playing Sunday League and the, you know, referee turns up, and if it's one you've never had before and they're young, you do sometimes go, ooh, not sure about, oh, this could be. Mm.
What's your first, what actually specifically is your first instinct then? They'd be too on it.
I assume they're going to be too
malleable,
weak, too quiet, right, too nervous. Yeah. Mm. Whereas if I see a bloke in his 60s rock up, I think it's got, oh, okay, we're safe here. This guy's going to lay down the law.
There is then a physical concern sometimes.
Some old school values with an older referee, you think?
The mobility could still be in question. But yeah, I think you can kind of flip it either way. But yeah, you're right. I've never heard the referee's age commented upon at the highest level.
Let's look at this referee in particular that Owen Hargreaves was referring to. Charlie, Glenn Nyberg, Swedish citizen.
Proud Swedish citizen.
35 years old. I mean, there's another aspect to Duncan Moore's question when he got in touch. Is that what qualifies a referee as being young? What would you consider a young referee to be? Younger than the age of a player who could conceivably be on the pitch?
I think if they're in their 20s, that to me sounds quite young. 35 doesn't sound that young somehow, because
I think
if I benchmark
it's for top
that
level though, Champions League.
Yeah, maybe. But when I benchmark that against players, they're like, any 35-year-old would seem like a veteran. So a ref being the same age as a veteran player doesn't seem crazy to me.
And I think the sort of the general lowering of the age of managers, we're used to seeing managers in their early 30s now sometimes. It's not uncommon. Whereas if there was a 35-year-old referee in the 90s, I think it would have been a big thing. Whereas now,
yeah, they've got younger because they're fitter, aren't they? Bit of background here, though, on Glenn Nyberg, Dave. He's been an Allsvenskan referee since 2013. So he was 25 when he started. Prodigious.
Listen, fair play.
We sometimes forget how young he is, don't we, Glenn Nyberg? Right, interesting one. Right, this came from JMA. The very early moments of Bournemouth versus Manchester United on Saturday. Setting the scene is World Feed commentator, a certain Mr. John Champion. Whatever happened to him?
Take a glance at the win probability, which is actually at odds with those that set the odds, because many of the bookmakers have Bournemouth down as favourites to win this game today.
First chance he got, Charlie, laying into the supercomputer.
Yeah, you love to see it. I really thought he was going to finish it there, because he said there was like a disconnect, something like, it's almost as if they make it up on the spot, or something like that, but that didn't quite come.
Not quite withering enough. Charlie, weird little podcast behaviour there, that when we get a video that we can't quite hear enough, all of us lean in with our headphones on nearer to our screen. That won't help.
You can't help but do it. It's completely instinctive.
Sorry, little podcast cliches for you there. Lovely stuff. Right, a wonderful twist and indeed turn on a delightful, beloved subgenre for us. Yeah, this is from the Grand National coverage on ITV on Saturday. Two-time winner Tiger Roll appearing on screen, being paraded in front of his adoring old fans. And this is what the commentator had to say.
It is good to see them, Niall. Thank you. Look at Tiger Roll. Full of the joys of spring, Steve. What a horse he was.
An absolutely amazing horse.
What a horse he was.
He's still there.
Yeah, as Rhys Withenshaw writes in, Dave, what a horse he was is quite the shout when Tiger Roll is still, for anybody's money, still a horse. Well, I mean, yeah, famously pulled up in one of his last races and then was never quite the same horse again. So, Charlie, it's great to see that it crosses species anyway, this phenomenon.
A lovely little flourish.
What a horse he was.
That comment came while he was being paraded in front of the supporters, which was nice. But it was a shame that it didn't come when he was just sort of spotted in the stand, just observing on the finish line.
This practice of Charlie of parading old winners of the Grand National around, even though they're retired, it is a bit like a sort of an old player coming back to a sort of clap above his head to the home fans who are not quite sure who he is.
Having an interview which no one can really hear at half time.
If they'd interviewed him, I would have died. Right, it's time for For My Sins Corner. This came from Andrew Rayburn, and it's from last Tuesday's episode of course, Pointless. So we're looking for the venerable phrase, for my sins, in this sample of popular culture. All you need to do is jump in when you think it's about to be uttered.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, Corey, welcome. Great to have you here. Tell us all about yourself. Hi, I was a teacher for about 20 years and now I have my own business. I'm an education consultant.
That's lovely. What do you like doing for fun?
I'm a season ticket holder at Burnley Football
for my
Club.
Sins.
For my
for sins.
My sins.
Splendid.
So we spend a lot of time on Turf Moor.
Dave Walker, buy a nose.
Ooh.
According to my Zoom recording, quite comfortably so as well. Got the whole phrase out before Eccleshare reacted.
Oh, I think that's a delay. I mean, we were both waiting for the same moment.
It does seem strange that you would have delayed it. It would seem a very straightforward for my sins.
Yeah, it was a tap-in.
But I do think Dave is quite on something of a resurgence when it comes to For My Sins Corner. Got a point to prove, haven't you, Dave?
Yeah. Really, really in a good moment.
Yeah. They've been very easy in our new era. We need some more difficult ones if possible. But people keep sending us minimal backlift for my sins, and they're no good, so I don't want them. Right, intriguing tweet popped up on Saturday night, Charlie, from Wayne Rooney. Gutted to not be making my debut on the iconic BBC Match of the Day show tonight. It's something I've wanted to do since I was little. Unfortunately, I've sustained a painful back injury during a holiday with my family, but I look forward to being part of the team in the near future. Does anybody dream of being on Match of the Day as a kid? You don't dream of being on the punditry panel as a kid, do you?
I don't know. Yeah, that is... some people would like more.
Really?
So, well, people like us are probably more likely to. Once we realise we weren't going to be playing football, it's like a sort of, you know, that would be amazing to be on it.
Did you realise that?
I reckon by the time I left primary school, honest with myself, right, I probably knew. And certainly, yeah, a couple of years in secondary school, it was apparent.
So your dreams turned to being a pundit.
Yeah, so at that point, I would have thought like, but what's the next best thing? Being on Match of the Day would be pretty good.
Yeah.
Sure, you should have realised that you were not going to be a pundit on Match of the Day if your football career had gone down the pan.
Well, I guess I was thinking the media landscape would have changed so much by that point that maybe I can fashion a career in journalism and then get on that way.
I thought you meant like, you know, like some top-level coaches have never played the game. They went straight into coaching as soon as they realised they weren't going to make it and just studied their way up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another avenue, potentially.
Huge, huge faith in the media landscape there that it wasn't going to be still ex-pros in 2024. Dave, I'm simply not buying it. I'm not buying it at all. It's just something you say, but it's not actually true.
Well, presumably Rooney would have been pretty certain that he was going to be a top-level player when he was little.
Yes, there's that.
And maybe he's mapping out the whole thing.
A lot of people have sort of slightly lesser dreams, Charlie. Do they dream of being, I don't know, Football Focus or Goals on Sunday? Goals on Sunday would be a good thing because it means you'd had a great career.
Always dreamed of being on the iconic Goals on Sunday sofa.
Always dreamed as a little kid, Dave, that I'd be on that not quite Soccer Saturday panel, you know, for like a midweek Carabao Cup game.
Soccer special. A few weeks ago, I was sending something in a WhatsApp group about, I think it might have actually been to you guys. I might have been sending you a clip or something that I'd heard. And I went to type, so-and-so has just said this on Soccer Saturday. But then I realised it wasn't. It was like a Tuesday night or something. But I couldn't bring myself to type the word soccer special.
And with good reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not quite as iconic, and I understand. Fair enough.
Do you reckon there are journalists, budding or otherwise, who back in the day dreamt of being on Sunday Supplement?
I would say so, wouldn't there?
Yeah.
I think it's a logical pinnacle of one's career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the sort of equivalent, I guess.
Yeah, I would say so. Right. Up in Scotland, as Ross County turned the game against Rangers on its head in the first 5 minutes of the second half to lead 2-1. Several people pointed out this on the BBC website. The new headline for the live blog, Charlie, read, Ross County 2, Rangers 1, dream restart as hosts strike twice. Can you have a dream restart? It's too mundane to me, the first 5 minutes of a second half.
Yeah.
It's not the same as first half. Dream restart. I've never heard it before in my life.
No, you might have, like, I think I'd have heard, like, dream start to the second half. I mean,
really?
Not quite snappy enough for a headline, is it?
Yeah, it's not snappy enough for a headline, but I think you might have heard that in commentary. Don't get me wrong, it's definitely odd and it's a dream start to the game, but I can slightly imagine that if it feels like a sort of, whoa, where has this come from? And you get like maybe three goals in the first kind of 5 minutes of the second half.
Okay. Assuming it is barely acceptable, Dave, are you doing the dreaming like before the game about the starts of the second half, or is it a dream you have in the 15 minutes at half time?
Just have a little nap. How would you describe it? What is the best way to describe this situation?
No, I think Charlie's fine with dream starts of the second half. I'm all right with that. It's just dream restart. I'd just never heard of it. Restarts to me is just too mundane a thing to be given dream status.
The restart is technically any resumption of play.
Yeah.
In any situation when the whistle's blown. It's not specifically the start of the second half, is it?
So you could describe a really good free kick as a dream restart. What a way to restart the game. They've scored.
a nightmare restart for Gabriel picking up the ball from David Raya. Who knows? Right, time for footballers' names and things. A little double header for you. First one came from Neil Smith. Here he says, a multiple Premier League winner unexpectedly playing a key role in the disinformation campaign against Hillary Clinton from the Daily Pod.
We had another secret weapon, Michael Silvestre. By day, Silvestre worked at the Walt Disney Company, but at night he operated Truth and Deception Technologies in Florida.
That's superb, because of the double identity thing you're half wondering. Silvestre had another job as well as being a professional footballer.
Mickey Mouse defender by day. And yeah, like that one. A lot of Premier League names seem to pop up in US politics circles. There was, of course, CIA agent Clint Hill, who was the one who climbed on the back of JFK's limousine as it sped off. All sorts of stuff. Right. Second one, I've resisted it for a very long time, but unfortunately, I'm afraid The Simpsons will now feature on the Football Clichés podcast. This came from Mark Prowse. It's from Season 4, Episode 19, The Front. And he asks, which Barclays-era referee does Bart aspire to become?
What are you going to change your name to when you grow up?
Lois Sanborn.
Steve Bennett.
Are you having that?
That's so niche.
It's not quite unusual enough a name, but I did find the clash of mediums quite funny, so I let it slide. Steve Bennett, yeah, fair play.
Whenever I would have seen that episode, probably would have been before I was aware of Steve Bennett. Wouldn't have burst onto the scene probably by that stage.
Yeah, let's find out. Season 4 of The Simpsons. Oh, it was 1993. I discovered earlier. Yeah. So Steve Bennett wasn't on the refereeing scene.
99 Premier League.
Steve Bennett. So he's one of those refs. I couldn't really.
It was in the conference.
The name didn't do much for me there, but looking at his photo, I know exactly who he is. If he rocked up at Sunday League, you'd be very, very assured of a.
I think, yeah, you'd feel you're in really safe hands.
Not sure of the dates exactly, but he was a linesman in the Premier League by the time that episode aired. So they could be aware of him. Little close-up on Sky, and that could have made it in. Anyway, that brings us to the end of part one of the adjudication panel. Back very shortly. Welcome back to Football Clichés. This is the adjudication panel. The first item of the second half comes from Simon James. Charlie says, on the final day of the Masters on Sunday, as Scotty Scheffler increased his lead to an almost unassailable point, the Five Live commentator said he had one arm in the sleeve of the famous green jacket as a variation of one hand on the trophy. Are we having this? Oh, I pretty much have all of them. I think every variant of this is acceptable because they're all brilliant and they all do exactly the job you want of them.
Yeah. I wonder if you could make it more about the jacket, though, that he's got one sleeve of the jacket or he's got the collar of the jacket or something. Because the jacket is sort of the prize, isn't it? Although maybe I guess you're talking about that he's going in with the whole action of putting it on.
There's a trophy as well, though, isn't there, Dave? For the Masters, there must be. Yeah, there is one. It's a little.
There is, but it's like all about the green jacket.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course.
The whole ceremony is it being placed on you by the previous winner. Like the previous winner sits next to them in the interview with like the jacket folded up on their lap, ready to put it on them. So it's not really about getting it; it is about putting it on.
Right.
That is the equivalent of lifting the trophy in the royal box.
From the implication of his lead at that point, Dave, I'm all right with one arm in one sleeve. That sounds about right. That sounds exactly the sort of position he was in.
Yeah, I think it is really. Yeah, it would be embarrassing if you had to take it off. From that point,
there's no way back from there.
It's been fitted already and everything.
Right. Scott Thomas in touch next. He says, I've just seen Andy Robertson doing the bouncing on the spot with twisty hips and elbows out to the side warm-up at Anfield and realised it's such an Andy Robertson movement. Are there any other warm-ups synonymous with a particular player? First of all, that is such a vivid description. I know exactly what it is. It's lining up for the sort of Premier League anthem in a line and he's jumping up and he's on the spot warm-up where he's sort of, you can see it, you can picture it, right?
Yeah, I think Sane was doing something similar mid-game the other night when there was a stoppage, so it was in a kind of like, I need to keep myself warm sort of way.
Yeah.
Quite limber. Son of a gymnast, of course.
I would accept, Dave, that this is an Andy Robertson specific warm-up thing. I quite like it. I can picture him doing, because he's quite high energy, so I can see why he would be doing that in the lineup before the game. I don't know if we're going to be able to get another synonymous warm-up with a particular player, but what would you say is the next most iconic warm-up thing? Jumping up for a header? Imaginary header?
I don't know if you'd see that much jumping up for a header.
Really? Is that not a thing?
Jumping, but not for a header, but just sort of jumping, just kind of doing a few little hop, bunny hops.
Yes. A weird little skip when you're coming on the pitch. That is a really weird thing.
I don't think you're going up for a header on the touchline. I think that's weird.
I swear players do it when they're coming out of the tunnel, when they're sort of first coming out onto the pitch.
Yeah.
They'll do the jump for the header.
But that's not really a warm-up, is it?
Tony Adams.
Well, but actually, I saw this pointed out recently. Like, that doesn't happen anymore. Because nobody runs out of a tunnel. Because you have to walk to do the Premier League anthem.
It's too ceremonial now, isn't it?
But you get it afterwards. Once the anthem has finished and the players disrobe take their jackets off and then run to like the other end, run to their half, that's when you get that sort of behaviour now. The one I would think of as well is the kind of slalom sprint.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
The little skip when coming on as a sub is a great shout. I don't think there's any physiological explanation for that. No sports scientist will back that up. I don't see it at all. Right, next question comes from Johnny Labour Craig. I was watching a recent episode of Match of the Day 2, and Troy Deeney was talking about Liverpool trying to score the perfect goal against Manchester United. I've heard loads of pundits mention this over the years, and it got me thinking, what is the perfect goal? There's an easy answer to this, right? What goal do they have in mind when they're talking about the perfect goal? It's quite a backhanded compliment, isn't it, as well?
Well, it's a relative of, like, they're trying to pass it in.
Yeah.
So I think, like, the Arsenal, the Wilshere goal against Norwich for Arsenal is a kind of, that's the kind of, when you criticise a team for you're just trying to walk it in, it's all tippy-tappy kind of thing, that's the perfect goal that I think a team is striving to score.
But it's a good point you make there about it being sort of backhanded compliment, because when they did actually score the perfect goal, everyone was going mad about it. One goal of the season.
That was the perfect goal.
Didn't have anyone going, oh, well, they just passed it one too many times in the build-up for me there. Could have shot a bit earlier.
Exactly. I don't think there's any part of that goal where it could have been scored quicker. So maybe it was the perfect goal. But Dave, interesting. I know, so the consensus is clear on what the perfect goal in people's minds is supposed to be or what they're trying to do. But how far away is the perfect goal from being a feasible, proper goal that should be scored by a sensible team? Like, how far is it? Two too many passes? What?
I think it's one of those situations you see a lot. For some reason, Arsenal do come to mind because they've kind of been labelled with this tag so much over the years. But all teams do it. City do it a lot now. It's kind of a modern football thing. When you've got an opposition team camped in the box and you've pressed up and your whole team is kind of surrounding them, and there are chances to shoot, but instead they keep passing it out wide to try and get the cut back, and they're just little intricate passes in and around the penalty area where they just will not shoot. They just want to engineer the perfect opportunity.
Right, okay.
You're right though, Adam, because it is only used in a kind of like, and look, they're trying to score the perfect goal. Yeah. It never is. And they've scored the perfect goal.
I just wondered how close it was to being a goal that everyone expected them to score in an ideal world and still be ruthless and clinical, but also flair-based as well. Johnny continues, Charlie, and says, I'd say more perfect goals would include long shots that go in off the bar, like Marcus Rashford's against City or Tony Yeboah's classic strike against Liverpool. Do you think that could ever... Could you ever imagine a situation where he's trying to score a perfect... He's trying to get it in off the bar.
No, you might hear that like he didn't need to be that precise with it.
Right.
When someone, he's got lows to aim at, he didn't need to go for the corner there.
Okay.
You might hear. It's the closest to that. But yeah, you wouldn't hear he's tried to score the perfect 30-yarder, I don't think. Unless they went for like a dink or a chip or something where there was no real need to. And it's like he's tried to make that look too pretty, too nice. So he's been too cute.
Oh, yeah, too cute. That would work. Yes. Yeah, maybe, yeah. Seeing the headlines, could that be an aspect of seeing his name in lights, maybe? Going for it. It's slightly related, Dave, to snatching at a chance, isn't it? Is that going for the big finish when a simple roll into the net would have been better?
Yeah, I think so. I think we might have seen the perfect goal, actually, this season. You must have seen Wes Burns' goal for Ipswich against Coventry.
Oh, yeah.
The perfect goal in inverted commas, yeah.
Yeah, well, on Sunday night was voted the goal of the season in the EFL, and because it's a great team move, it's got that
and a great finish,
and then it's like a really outlandish, spectacular Travella finish with the outside of the boot.
There was a Southampton goal as well, Dave, wasn't there, this season that was similar, an amazing build up, and then I think it was from outside the box, the goal. So again, it kind of had the 2-1.
I think it might have been against Watford.
Phenomenon, when you see a goal unfolding like that. That when you see it getting into its latter stages, you know that this will be a great team goal, Charlie. Not only are you willing it to go in for that reason, but when it does go in, you hope that the players celebrate in a fashion that that suggests that they recognise all the stuff that went before it. So they're not just celebrating in isolation. They're sort of pointing it out at each other and going, how good was that between us all? It was brilliant, wasn't it?
That's a really good point. And I do wonder, another perfect goal, 2006, Argentina against Serbia. I think it was Cambiasso who eventually scored it.
Yeah.
One of those where pretty much everyone in the team played a part in it. But I bet you a lot of the time, well, maybe they realised how good it was. But you know, often like if you've been at a game, you don't realise until after... You're like, oh yeah, that was in the lead up to that goal, wasn't it? You sort of, because you don't appreciate it fully in the moment. Yeah. I do wonder if sometimes they don't quite realise just how good a move was.
You don't really appreciate it until you see it sped up on BBC Match of the Day.
I was going to say that as well. I wonder if they're thinking, like, a goal's been amazing, a goal's had an amazing team move when there's going to be the quite primitive speeding up.
Was it a lightning counter-attack? Or I don't know, I'm going to need a stopwatch at the bottom of the screen to confirm it.
Why are you trying to celebrate with us, mate? That was a different phase. That doesn't count.
Yeah, possession switched hands. You're not involved. Fuck off. Right. I spend a lot of my life, an uncomfortable amount of my life, Dave, on brilliant website ICDB, the Internet Commentator Database. It's very useful for checking who's commentating on what game and who I can pin the blame on 48 hours later on a podcast. But a little section of this user sort of maintained website really tickled me. There is, it's an insane website. It goes back decades in terms of pinning commentators to particular games, broadcasters, co-commentators, all that sort of thing. But there's a little section on the homepage called Unknown Commentators. Now, as of today, there are 421 games on this website that have unidentified commentators. They're still looking for people to confirm who commentated on. And there's a little teaser list of games that they're still looking for, presumably ordered in terms of high profileness for them, maybe the easiest one to get. Top of the list, Everton versus Manchester United, Satanta Sports Ukraine HD. That is the golden goose.
When was this game? Are they still? Is it recent? Are they still going?
The homepage has changed it now. Now they're looking for... I didn't know Satanta Sports Ukraine HD definitely even existed.
Amazing.
Good to know it's in HD. The most prolific commentator on Satanta Sports Ukraine HD, Charlie, is Dmytro Dzulai. He must be the Martin Tyler of Ukraine.
How many of these have you seen and thought you could get the answer to? Or are they all foreign broadcasters where you wouldn't recognise the voices?
I haven't delved into it too far. I'd be stunned if I can trump the investigative efforts of ICDB.tv. Not my area of speciality, I have to say. I don't watch a lot of foreign channels, so don't think I could beat them. Anyway, I just wanted to put it out there in case anybody knows or was watching that at the time. Right, so it was the eclipse last week. Everyone very excited about that. Obviously, Charlie, the eclipses inspire a lot of deep thinking about civilization. A lot of people get very sort of troubled by eclipses and what they might mean for the bigger picture for the human race, right?
I believe so.
Yeah. One of civilization's deepest thinkers is Matt Letissier. He was a guest on an hour-long live stream the day after the eclipse with a guy called Tom Numbers. Tom Numbers markets himself as the world number one in simple gematria. Now, gematria is assigning a number to a letter and then making the connections between words and phrases to reveal a global conspiracy. So you add up all the letters in a word and that creates a total number, and then it links to other words and phrases, seemingly, you know, revealing an astonishing network of things. Some people might suggest it's quite convenient. Some people might see a pattern emerging. Anyway, this is what this guy does. He's incredible at it. He can see a word and add up the numbers straight away. That's how deep into it he is. Anyway, so his latest guest was Matthew Letissier, who spent basically the whole hour realizing slowly that he was completely out of his depth in terms of the things that was going on. He's basically just nodding along in the same way that you might nod along to a taxi driver whose theories are way beyond anything that you care about. You just go, well, yeah, might be, could be, yeah, could be. And that's basically what Letissier was doing for the whole hour. These are the highlights. They get better as it goes on, and I can't wait to share them with you. Dave, it was basically a whole hour of eclipse chat, a lot of chat about Donald Trump, the truth. You get the idea, sort of.
Yep.
Yeah. Didn't go too crazy. It was quite quaint. And this guy's quite a benign presence. He seems like quite a nice chap. He's just deep into this stuff. So here's clip one. They're talking about the significance of the number 182.
Change multiverse, 182. Turn to Jesus, 182. A lot of people have been doing that in the last few years. Mm. The kingdom of heaven is 182. New Jerusalem law, 182. Real Ivanka Trump, 182. Time jump, eternal time jump is 182. And get this, so bands, you talked about Busted. There's another band. I don't know if you're a fan of theirs or not. Blink 182.
You won't believe where this goes.
I've heard of them, but
okay.
I'm not a fan, yeah.
Yeah, so I've heard of them, yeah. Blink 182. Blink, if you spell the word blink in numbers, it comes to 48. yesterday was 4.8, and 1.82 is the Fux capacitor dimensional change, a Hadron Collider. I wonder, I don't even know if Blink 182 are aware of that, but why did they pick
that number?
Yeah, and why did they pick the word blink? Have you noticed on Match of the Day? So here in the UK, me and Matt will watch the soccer at the weekend, and there's one of the commentators, he's closely connected with the Man U class of 92, he's done documentaries with them, but he's now a commentator. Do you know, they've got, can't think of his name, but he's one of the main commentators now, but he did, he kind of worked his way up.
Right.
I know he did stuff with the class of 92 back in the day.
Okay.
Almost without fail, every week he says, he brings it into his commentary. He says, blink of an eye. He does it all the time. I don't know if you've heard that on Match of the Day or noticed it, but each week he'll say, when it's his game, he puts the phrase blink of an eye into his commentary. He's been doing it for weeks now.
Okay.
Which BBC Match of the Day commentator is part of the Illuminati?
He means Neville, doesn't he? Is that, that's like, because there is no, he's surely talking about Neville. There's no BBC, there's no Match of the Day commentator who fits that description.
That's a reasonable assumption, I think. I don't think this guy's massively football literate. I don't think it's his big thing, I have to say.
He talks about watching the soccer.
And he just thinks anyone on, he's calling them all commentators and Match of the Day. Yeah, I think you're right. I think he is thinking about Neville. Because there's no Match of the Day commentator who came up with the class of 92.
I don't know.
Dreamt about being on Match of the Day when they were in the class of 92. I mean, Letizia seems almost, even Letizia seems a little bit like, I'm in too deep, I'm not sure any of this actually makes any sense.
Yes, and that is pretty much the vibe for the entire hour. There are bits where he suddenly sort of tries to get it back to his sort of, you know, specialist subject matter of COVID and things like that. The guy sort of swings it back again straight away. It's incredible. Letizia barely gets a word in edgeways in this whole thing. Next one. Well, here we go.
Our two truther, valiant warriors standing up for the people and the movement, as Matt Letizia, obviously, and Ricky Lambert. They both played for Southampton. The nickname for Southampton is the Saints. And they both wore the number 7 shirt. And if you do 7-7, 77, guess what that number comes up to? Christ. Christ equals 77.
Wow.
Yeah.
All Letizia could do is just nod and go, fair play. Listen, fair play.
He literally could say anything. It's like, so?
Yes, as it will unfold. Here's the third clip. A very unexpected football legend gets dropped into the conversation here.
Basically, Johan Cruyff plus April 26th in numbers comes to 365. 365 comes to...
You won't believe.
The Winners Protection Programme. You heard it here first. I have a feeling that Johan is not gone. That might upset people. It might give people a lot of hope. I think he's not gone. I think he'll be one that comes and shares truth later down the line.
For goodness sake.
Wow. I was not expecting the Witness Protection Programme there. If you add together the letters in Johan Cruyff's name and his birthday, you get the Global Witness Protection Programme. It's just astonishing. Now,
this guy's like a Mark Wootton character. I can't believe this guy's real. This is like an amazing...
Who's Mark Wootton?
He's a character comedian who creates these sorts of... Like, exactly these sorts of people. Just totally kind of wacky, like, nonsensical sort of characters. This guy just... Yeah, this is amazing.
I'm desperate for it to be a parody, Dave. I'm desperate to be some sort of massive wind-up for Matt Letizia, but he barely engages it anyway, so I don't think he's really a victim to it, even if it was. So they've covered so much stuff, Dave, on this stuff. Global conspiracies, the eclipse, Donald Trump, Ricky Lambert, and finally, he asks him this.
A couple of football questions for you, Matt, before we wrap up, unless there was other rabbit holes you wanted to go down.
No, we want to keep this up.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we've been all right. This has been good. So, one of which is, who would be your starting 11 for England in the Euros? If they're all fit.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question because there's so many...
Suddenly, it goes from the most ridiculous chat in all of all time, and it just becomes like a Paddy Power kind of corporate video, an event or something. Like, it's difficult. I mean, he's got a lot of prestige.
What's amazing is how Letizia shifts from like these global conspiracies so easily. Like, and actually, to be fair, he looks very relieved, doesn't he? He's like, oh, thank fuck for that. I'm in my comfort zone.
Yeah.
I can lean forward and just, yeah, this is an absolute gimme.
Amazing.
He can't even be bothered to answer it. He just says, well, there's a core of five players. They're just, yeah, just pick those and that's it. it's an astonishing hour of, I got completely engrossed in it. And now all I can think of is letters and numbers. Anyway, Charlie, speaking of which, if you take the number of goals Letizia scored for Southampton, that's 209. If you subtract the number of Premier League free kicks he scored, 7, and then add on how many times he won BBC Goal of the Season, 1, what do you get?
203.
And what adds up to 203? Keys and Grey Corner. Now, first item, you'll remember a compilation made recently by Nozza, a man they're dubbing the new Brian's Gun. It was of Andy Gray's imaginary conversations between players. Here's the follow-up. It is amazing. I think it's even better. It's Andy Gray answering his own questions.
He's entitled to be a little nervous, but was he? You bet your life he wasn't.
Can he win it? He does. Can Rochelle help it on? Yes.
It's off, it's wide. Now, is he going to shut off? No, he's not.
Am I surprised? No.
Are there any nerves?
Not in McAllister's mind.
And can you get across the defender and head it in? You bet he can. Now the target's away. Can he provide the cross? Yes, he can. Can he provide a header? Yes, he can.
Who's up there in the middle of the goal there? Didi Haman.
Look how easy he gets the cross in. He's not pressed enough. Neither is the marking good at the back post. But the Arsenal care, not a jot. Is he going to shoot? No, he's not. It's a brilliant stand-up from Brolin.
It's half clear to the edge of the box, but who reacts first? Ronnie Whelan.
Now, does he do it too late? Now, watch again. The number two is the key. Now, is he too late? He definitely is too late.
But do the Liverpool fans care? Does Ryan Babel care? You bet your life they don't. The only thing that matters is that scoreline in the top left-hand corner.
That last one, Charlie, is the absolute distillation of this mini phenomenon. It is Andy Gray asking us if individual X cares or not, and you bet your life they don't. And it is the perfect combination.
Yeah, I love the double questions. Those are the best in that. Like, there was one where it's just, can one player win a header? Yes. Can the other player win his flick on? Also yes. And then the player scores. So good. The Didi Haman popping up as well.
Obviously serves a great function in the Andy Gray punditry universe this, Dave. I think the most intriguing subtype there is where and who pops up? Player X. Why do we need that? Like, what function does that particular one serve? Because we know he scored the goal because we've already seen it.
But it's...
Is it a Johnny on the spot
it's
situation?
A Johnny, like? It's kind of Johnny on the spot thing, isn't it? Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think it does serve a purpose. You sometimes hear this sort of rhetorical device used by commentators as well, but it doesn't work as well. It's much better to reflect when you know what's happened and you can answer the question emphatically, because sometimes commentators will sort of ask it and then the thing that they want to happen doesn't happen.
Right.
Yeah, like, can he finish? No. Yeah. It's really disappointing.
Yeah, De Bruyne. Can he find someone with this ball? You're leading it down a path and you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's a really strange commentary device, isn't it? Like, why even pose the question? But yeah, curious. Right. First bit of lovely magical keys from this weekend comes from James Lyons. He says, even Richard Keys realises that this is too Richard Keyes-y halfway through.
I'm hesitant to mention April the 14th, of course, was the day the Titanic sank. I'm partway through that now, aren't I?
Yeah, definitely partway through that.
Obviously, very same day that Arsenal and Liverpool's title chances went under.
I thought he was going to start adding up the numbers of the Titanic. Lovely little connection to make, Charlie. Is it too dramatic? No, definitely not. Definitely not.
Keyes-y famously into his boats in that like MTV crib style thing. He shows a big boat he has at his Doha home.
Yes, he does. Let's hear about that.
My wife bought me Titanic. Oh. I have a fixation I always have had with the story of the Titanic. It's a
a fascinating tale.
A scale there model of the Titanic in his Doha home. Yeah. If you haven't watched the semi-infamous 2015 Be In Sports featurette, there was a tour of Richard Keys' Doha home. Seek it out. It's on Daily Motion, which is where all the real good stuff is, and enjoy all of it. Right. Finally, here's Keezy on Alejandro Garnacho committing the ultimate footballer sin on social media, slagging off Erik ten Hag in the process, leading to a very unexpected collision of content universes.
Young players make mistakes, he said, but
especially in social media.
Well, Mark Goldbridge, who's a YouTuber, yeah, he's got his own channel. He wasn't too impressed, and then Garnacho liked those tweets.
He didn't write it. He liked it.
And then later unliked them naturally, but the damage had been done from Ten Hag's perspective.
We unliked it after?
Yeah. Inevitably, somebody said something.
Get that off. Yeah. His agent would probably say, by the way, unlike it quick.
Further proof, Charlie Equisher, that there is simply no competition for the most awkward news story in all of football, which is a footballer liking something on social media. It is the pits.
That was really sweet, though, the way Andy kind of chimed in with a bit of an explanation. Like, oh, yeah, no, but he would have unliked it.
And he showed,
he didn't write it. Okay, he didn't write it. Yeah, no, he just liked it. Okay.
Andy Gray showing full comprehension of how social media works, which was really crucial to this exchange, Dave, because it really would have fallen apart if he didn't.
McAteer seems surprised by the notion of being able to unlike something. You thought he'd have been
he's
on there.
He's going to hastily go back and unlike a load of stuff.
Yeah, a real epiphany for him. Fascinating to see Goldbridge entering the Keys universe. What a combo they could be, Dave.
He's a YouTuber.
Yeah, curious to know what he'd make of Goldbridge. Would he sort of admire his forthrightness, or would he be everything that's wrong with kind of football
hard
fan media in 2024?
Really hard to say.
Mm.
I don't know how familiar Keezy actually is with Goldbridge. Goldbridge will obviously know about Keys, but they're a lot more similar than, you know, if you were to sort of take their transcripts, their opinions are probably quite similar.
There's a quiz round for you. Who said it? Mm. Right. Anyway, right. Thanks to you, Charlie Eccleshare.
Thank you.
Thanks to you, Dave Walker.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back on Thursday with your Mesut Haaland dicks. See ya.